Okay, hi, I'm Matt. I work on global risk. So hanging in a Jain temple is this image of an elephant, and it's depicting the parable of the blind monks trying to interpret what an elephant is by each examining one part and extrapolating from that. And this elephant, it could be black or grey or whatever your preferred kind of elephant is. Only the gurus in the corner have the full integrated understanding of the elephant. And the text roughly reads, the gurus are those who uphold the doctrine of many-sided truth. So what I'm going to present today is just some tiny highlights from an integrative review across six important fields and how they apply to global risk reduction. So if we start with what you might call disaster risk reduction studies, exemplified by such things as the Sendai framework and implemented by many countries' national emergency management agencies, they often deploy effective strategies for disaster risk reduction. But as has been noted by the UN in their global assessment report, disaster impacts continue to increase despite this activity, and often response is prioritized over prevention. The GAR notes that basically a key blind spot is this failure to account for 1 in 100 or even 1 in 1,000 year events that could be catastrophic, you know, if they do occur. And in general, DRR as it stands basically addresses local hazards, or tends to, as they occur. It has a preponderance for concern about climate change. It assumes often that aid from outside the affected area will be available. It has little capacity to address cross-border risks across countries, and it tends to omit the largest global risks because of that. So if we move on to what are the largest global risks, well, global catastrophic risk and existential risk studies describe these global risks that would threaten all of humanity at once and exceed the response capacities of the resources available around the world. These global catastrophic risks are defined, they have their own separate literature, and we've seen previously COVID-19, which killed 0.3% of the world's population, World War II, which killed 3% of the population, and the Justinian Plague, which killed 30% of the world's population. But there's also the risk of nuclear war, engineered pandemics, volcano catastrophes, catastrophic infrastructure failures, whether due to electromagnetic pulses, space weather, or AI run amok, and so on. Some of these threaten the extinction of humanity, just ask the dinosaurs. And the UN has noted that rising catastrophic risk and existential risk could lead to a persistent crisis and breakdown of human systems. The UK House of Lords has noted that we need learning and transparency around extreme risk. The US even passed a Global Catastrophic Risk Management Act back in 2022, although the associated RAND analysis and report has been taken down since the return of the Orange Man baby. But global catastrophic risk studies, they tend to be historically focused on the hazard, they're hazard focused, and often on techno-solutionism. And most national risk assessments exclude global catastrophic risk from their assessments, despite the immense tail risk threat. So moving on to national risk assessments. National risk assessments often take an all hazards approach and develop risk scenarios relevant to countries. But many have been criticised in practice for a range of reasons. For example, the implicit value assumptions tied up in them, the crude frequency impact matrices that they often generate, the routine omission of cross-border risks and global catastrophic risks, and even when these cross-border risks are included in national risk assessments, there's often inexplicable heterogeneity across regions where you would expect likelihoods and impacts to be correlated. Again, they often focus on individual hazards and explain how and why risks are allegedly already addressed by governments. It's okay, we've got this under control according to best practice. They seldom detail potential future mitigation opportunities or options for improving the situation. And they seldom consider the convergence or amplification dynamics across multiple risks, which brings us to the field of systemic risk and polycrisis studies. For example, within this field, we have the Cascade Institute's stress trigger crisis model, which illustrates that we've got these rising stresses across many global systems and global domains. It's not just climate heating. There's at least 13 other systemic stresses, including things like demography, geopolitics, misinformation, new technologies, and so on. which often fly under the radar of national risk assessment as it stands. These stresses, either alone or in combination with some critical trigger, which could be a global catastrophic risk or one of these other things we've just mentioned, or it could be a hazard thrown up from within these systems themselves, an endogenous hazard that we've created ourselves, and this could tip coupled human, natural, global systems into disequilibrium. There's a risk of this. And that brings with it the possibility of global collapse of critical systems like energy, food, or communications. In other literature in this broad area, we see people deploying complex adaptive systems theory, illustrating the existence of what we might conceive of as a global system as a whole, comprised of the interactions of all these subsystems, with hazards not merely external shocks, but inherent in the systems themselves. And moving further, some have tried to model this interaction of systems, this polycrisis, to deduce attractor states in the global systems, or in that global system. And the news is not good, with the so-called Mad Max attractor being the largest basin of attraction in one of these models. And so global systems really need to evolve away from this kind of basin of attraction. But even this field of all these interactions and so forth seems to miss some deeper generative mechanisms that warrant attention. So we can ask, what is the cause of this polycrisis? And often when we analyze risk and these systems' human drives and behaviors are often sort of assumed background conditions, but they're variables in their own right with their own explanatory stack. And we can ask different questions about the cause of human behavior and actions. We can ask what's the mechanism of some behavior, perhaps it's a cognitive bias. We can ask what's the development of that behavior or bias, how does it come about in our context. We can ask what's its function, what's it supposed to be doing, why is it there? And we can ask what's its origin in evolutionary terms, how did it come to be? And the first two questions give us approximate explanation of human behavior, and the second two give us an ultimate explanation of the way things are in our societies and in our coupled systems. And we can't fully address global risk without understanding these mechanisms of behavior and evolution. And this is partly, but not exclusively, a consideration of invisible hand dynamics as well. So, moving on to two more fields, human behavior. This is important, but it is not the focus of my talk today. But in the context of global risk, the literature on human behavior reports on cognitive biases, the information ecology, institutional entrenchments, and so forth. Ultimately, human behavior really is transmitted developmental environment. We've created this space in which our behavior emerges. And there's a whole literature on how culture and behavior evolves over time. So that brings us to evolution and evolvability. So there is a significant literature applying evolutionary theory to human culture and behavior. And there is a small emerging field within this, applying this thinking to global risk. So human culture can evolve on relatively short timeframes. We see mere change, which might include things like fashions and accents and so forth, but we also see adaptation, the emergence of complex solutions to complex, difficult problems. And you might put disaster prevention and response in this kind of category. But importantly, there is also maladaptation that emerges when things go wrong in the system that is supposed to produce adaptations. Maladaptations, think things like burning fossil fuels, converting farmland to dairy farming, often locally adaptive behaviours, but globally maladaptive when aggregated, when you see the emergent effects. And so these kind of tragedy of the commons effects are often sustained by psychological dynamics, in-group, out-group psychology, famine psychology, and a whole host of other drivers of human behaviour. And in many cases, we see that in those invisible hand dynamics are central to these processes, even when human-directed activity is acting in certain places and on certain institutions or actions. So I think that this evolution literature is rich for informing our understanding of global risk. And I just want to focus on one aspect of this one field, which is evolvability, the concept of evolvability. Evolvability is the potential of a system to generate complex adaptive solutions to the problems that it faces. And it requires some formal characteristics as ingredients for this to occur, things such as variation, modularity, fidelity of information, stable selective forces, and so on. And in one study on the issue of polycrisis, Jorgensen et al. Actually introduce this, they have the insight to introduce this concept of evolvability as a functional capacity that we could deploy for escaping Anthropocene traps, as they describe them. And they define five high-level ingredients of this of evolvability, which they say could be enhanced through governance, learning, and institutional change. But some institutions, technologies, and norms are exploitative and contribute to risk, and they persist because they replicate or spread effectively. In this context, they are born of evolvable systems because of this evolvability. So here's my two cents. There are actually additional formal criteria beyond what Jorgensen and so forth put forward for adaptive evolvability in the evolution literature. One example of that is notably the need to block outlaws or block defectors. Think cancer suppression in biological systems. Blocking outlaws is foundational to evolvability, to evolving adaptive solutions. And in the table on the right here, it's a partial map of some of Sterelny's evolvability conditions and why they matter. And in the final column, how it appears that these conditions are actually degrading globally in our present context. Instead of a supply of variation, we often see standardization and homogenization. Instead of modularity, we often have tight coupling across systems. Instead of fidelity, we have institutional churn. Instead of a stable context, we have exponential change. And instead of outlaw suppression, we have weak enforcement of risk-generating agents, and so on. Global systems have insufficient risk-suppressing mechanisms. And here's the one-line summary. I contest that looking across these six fields, the world may be undermining its ability to evolve cumulative adaptations in the face of risk. So, putting it all together, what are the implications of integrating these six fields? Well, we have disaster risk reduction operating, struggling along in a context where global systems are stressed. We have human behaviour and its ultimate causes critically driving many global stresses, whether it's in energy or ecosystems and so on. We have external hazards, most notably the threat of global catastrophic risk, which needs to be prevented because it's likely, if it occurs, to trigger these stress systems into crisis. But most global risk is probably emerging from within the global systems as the subsystems interact and stress each other. And if we strike crisis, there's three outcomes that are possible: adaptation and anti-fragility, which would be good, business as usual chaos, or the risk of a catastrophic collapse. So in order to avoid this, we need to nurture the ingredients of evolvability, the substrate of both conscious and unconscious adaptive processes. And we can do that by developing that the ingredients for evolvability will allow us to address both reducing system stresses and transforming away from risk, but also evolving adaptations to crisis should crisis occur. And governance needs to oversee these dynamics. That should be one of its roles, in particular, suppressing the evolutionary outlaws whose locally adaptive actions give rise to global risk. So, last slide. People often ask, is there a meta-crisis? Is it right to formalise this as a meta-crisis? And having surveyed these six fields, now as the guru looking down on the elephant, I say yes, human systems are now throwing up risk faster than we can address it because of exponential change. Move fast and break things is not conducive to evolving complex adaptations. But the present dynamics also undermine the very mechanisms that allow risk-reducing adaptations to emerge. So we're kind of cutting off our nose to spite our face. This is the meta-crisis, and to solve it, we need to address the ultimate, not merely proximate, causes of global risk. Thank you.